Well, here we are again. This is Bob Brundage, still in York, Pennsylvania. And today we're talking to Mr. Dick O'Dick, and he's here enjoying the dancing. We're here to find out about Dicko's life history, if you will. So, Dicko, tell us... by the way, I forgot to mention this is November 29th today, 1996. So, Dicko... give us an idea of what life was like before you got into square dancing. Where were you born and brought up?
You know, I'm always embarrassed to talk about myself.
Oh, yeah?
I just never like to do that. But in view of the fact that we're trying to make this something for archives, I will.
Okay.
I was born in a little one-room cabin in Oklahoma in the Cherokee Strip country. As soon as I was born, my dad had built another house, and I was the youngest of three children. And we had a ranch in Oklahoma. He had been one of the few that did the run into Oklahoma. And he was about 15 years old then, and he'd made the run in and settled in the place where I was born. And we had a ranch there, a small ranch. We raised cattle and sheep, all that. My dad wanted me to be a cattle judge, and I ended up taking courses and becoming a pharmacist in Oklahoma University. That's where I met Lou, and the last year I was in college in 1941, of course, you know what happened. So I had already gotten my commission in the ROTC, and so I was called to active duty almost immediately. July of 41. And Lou and I married in October of 41, and I was stationed with the Air Force at Randolph Field, and then I moved to Ellington Field and did a lot of cadet training in Air Force, air cadet training in Uvalde, Texas, and San Antonio and that.
Okay.
And then I was sent overseas and ended up in Europe. And I was in guerrilla warfare, sabotage, OSS, Wild Bill Donovan operations, broken dagger stuff.
There you go.
And got into became counterintelligence agent, and we worked the Russian Cold War system. And then about 1948, I was sent back, the end of 48, to San Antonio again, and we had our children, and I was a captain at that time in the Air Force. And we ended up in San Antonio, not much money, no anything, furniture, anything. So we had to buy furniture, buy a car, buy a house, raising two kids. And about the 21st of every month, we were down to pig knuckles trying to eat. I tell you, it was close.
Right.
So Lou and I, we didn't like to go out to the officers' club and drink and dine the elbows much. We weren't much for that. So one day, Lou, it was about the middle of July, and Lou was looking at the local paper, and she said, "Hey, it's an Alamo Heights Gazette, I think it was." She says, "Let's go do square dancing." I said, "Nah, I saw it in Oklahoma. No, I don't think I want to get into that." "Oh, well," says, "it only costs $4 a month for four lessons." It was only a dollar a lesson. Well, she ended up, and I was reading the paper, and all right. And sure enough, I ended up on a square dance floor in Alamo Heights, San Antonio, Texas. The caller and the teacher was a guy named Lily Lee Baker. Lily Lee and her fiddler named Henry.
Okay.
Henry was her fiddler, and those two came in from Austin, and she gave lessons at the Lions Club there in Alamo Heights. Well, the first time I got on the floor, I just looked around and said, "Hey, here's a whole bunch of people I've never met before, and they are not in the military."
Right.
You know, and that kind of took me. Well, we got started, and the next thing you know, we'd made good friends with the couples that started the square with us, and we had a great time for about 6 lessons, I think, 6 weeks a lesson. That was it. And after 6 weeks, you could go out and dance. Well, that was great. And sure enough, about the time we graduated, we had costumes matching the Ford Cup of the Boys. We were the biggest stuff there was.
Right.
We got out to this festival there in San Antonio. They had a festival going at that point. Well, we never got through anything. We were absolutely disasters. People would come and try to help us walk away. And we laughed, had a big time. Well, we went back to this guy's house. This was in early 49. We went back to this fellow's house, and we moved out the dining room table, and it says, look, we're going to do some of these dances. Well, one of the two of the dances they had were Jonesy Jones and his Four Gent Star and his Three Ladies Chain. Well, we got to working on those dances, and it got nobody could figure out what. And I was sitting over in the corner. There's three couples working. I was sitting in the corner. I said, hell, I can do that. Here's the way it goes. And somebody said, well, if you're so smart, get up and call it. I went up, started it. We did the Three Ladies Chain. I showed them how to do it and opened my mouth, and there it was.
Okay.
You know, you could just, I just they knew it right. I said, my God, here I am. But my dad was an auctioneer, and I picked up some of that from him, of course, and the rhythms of the call and everything.
Right.
Well, it wasn't just but a few weeks. We had, well, no, a few months, I guess. In late 49, I got transferred to Washington, the Pentagon. And we came in the Pentagon and looked around, and no square dancing. A fellow named Wiley Goodsell. He was a bishop in the Mormon Church. Well, Wiley... We got into him. We found him. He was doing a one-nighter at a firehouse. Well, okay, let's go out. Well, we went out all dressed up in our costume. Here was people in everything, sweatsuits, sweatshirts, everything. But we danced, and Wiley picked us up. And then he started to, we went to dance with him for a while, and pretty soon I got into it, and I did a few calls, and we were a bunch of us in the basement. You know how you do.
Sure.
And the next thing you know, I was into it, and we started a class. And in 1950, I started regularly calling while I was on duty at the Air Force in there. And it was a kind of an avocation, you know.
Sure.
For $25, you did a nice performance, and you felt good.
Right.
Well, that's how we got started into it.
Oh, that's great.
It just, I got dragged into it, and there it was. Yeah.
Never regretted a minute.
And never regretted a minute. Been at it ever since.
Yeah. So how did you make the transition into Western-style square dancing?
Well, when I was in San Antonio, that was Western. That was so-called Western-style, Herb Gregerson style.
Okay.
You know, where you go out and he says, do-si-do, and the Texas do-si-do.
Sure.
Caller goes out, has a cigarette, comes back in, you're still doing do-si-do. That was that country west, lots of arm swings.
Yeah.
And back here in the east, of course, it was not so much the arm swing. Lloyd Shaw had his influence here with Wiley and Evan Jenkins, who was very much into that field.
Mm-hmm.
So I became acquainted with them, and I danced with Evan, and I danced with Wiley, and I did some calling and working, and pretty soon the Western focus began to take effect. And so we went from the patterns of the two-head ladies crossover and by your opposite stand type of thing, into the Western things, and then during that period, Evan Jenkins formed the National Capital Area Square Dance Leaders Association, and I helped him form it, and so I'm one of the originals of that. And it's still in operation here. It's been, 45 years later, and so I've gradually moved into the, well, I came, brought the country Western with me, or rather the Western style of arm swing dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And about 4 years after that, I was sent to staff at command school in Alabama. We went down, we got acquainted with the Birmingham crowd, and I worked with them a bit. Then I went to Ottawa, Canada, and Angus McMorran was the man trying to do Eastern square dancing then, and we got acquainted, and it took off in Ottawa like wildfire. Yeah, the queen had been, well, the princess, she was Princess Elizabeth.
Right.
She had been there about a few months before I arrived, and she square danced the old traditional
I remember
dance.
That, yeah.
Yeah, and that Ottawa was hot to square dance.
Sure.
They wanted to dance so bad. We opened up the doors, Angus and I, and good Lord, we had, the hall was loaded just immediately.
Yeah.
And it just went from there.
there, so I became quite a full-time, so-called full-time caller, while I was in the Air Force. And that went on through, was transferred to Detroit. I did about 4 years in Detroit, built up considerably there, started calling, teaching callers what I knew. And we started a square dance camp up in the Muskoka Lakes above Toronto, and Angus and I ran that for numbers of years. We bring guys up for a week-long vacation camp. There was only one up there in that country at that time.
Yeah.
And from there I went, and then from Detroit we did about 4 years in Detroit. Dave Taylor rose to fame in that Detroit area.
Yeah,
I can remember when Dave was down in our basement where I was working as a couple or a square. Dave was looking through my records to see what he used to call. And the next thing, Dave exploded, and he became a very famous caller.
Right.
And that's how, then from Detroit, I came back to Washington.
Okay.
And I've been there ever since working.
Well, tell us about some of the big events that you've been involved with, like national conventions and so forth.
Well, I've done a few things with the nationals. I haven't gone to nationals a lot. I got involved with Color Lab the year after it started, when Bob started it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I get highly involved with Color Lab, and I've been, I hate to say it, but Color Lab's been good to me. They've given me two outstanding, extraordinary achievement awards and a milestone award, and I don't know why. I've just worked the local systems when I've been around, but somebody thought I was worth giving a milestone, so I'm among those wonderful guys who got it. I still don't know how I've got to be a milestone award winner. I got involved with Caller Lab a great deal, and ended up now I'm a caller coach, and John Jones got me involved in being the caller coach chairman of that committee, and we organized it a lot, and I got a little outstanding achievement award for that.
Okay.
And I got to working with the Canadian border problems of callers coming back and forth.
Nice.
And I worked with that a couple of years very hard to get that loosened up. And I failed, and in failing they still gave me an outstanding achievement award. I don't know how that happened. But and they've still got their problems, of course.
I didn't realize there was a problem with the border.
Quite a lot of problems, yeah. Not so much has been, well, it wasn't initially for the Americans, it was for the Canadians.
I see.
And then they got to tightening up, and now it's they have to get work permits and all that thing, and fill out forms and pay taxes in both places. You know, it's still kind of a mess, even though the free trade agreement started. The free trade agreement involved everybody but artists and performing arts, and they included us in that, and therefore we couldn't get this thing to work back and forth across the border. Just one of those little things.
Yes. Well, I know when I was on one of my tours, one of my dancers was in Winnipeg, and when I crossed the border, they said, what are you going to do? I'm going to call a square dance, and, you know, be working for money? Well, show me your contract, and where's your work permit? And what? But they finally let me go, and as long as I promised to leave Canada the next day.
They've really tightened it.
But then they paid me in Canadian money, so
lost a little bit that time, huh?
Right.
Yeah, I was with the RCAF in Canada, and I know the problems up there trying to get back and forth across the border, particularly from the U.S. side.
Right.
But, you say, what are big things I've been involved in? One of my dreams has always been at one time, and still is, to have the local callers in an area become involved, rubbing elbows on the stage with men of national or fame, they're really great people, great callers, great leaders. So in 1970s, I started the Washington Fall Cotillion. See, Washington, Waska had its big Washington Area Square Dance Cooperative has a big festival every year in the spring.
Yeah.
And they had, after a couple of years, they got upset because some of the local callers were being a little nasty about it. They didn't get the right slots, and they didn't get to call when they wanted to, and so they threw them all out. And so that was our own fault, callers, you know, saying being greedy. And
right.
So when I came back in 1960, they'd thrown all the callers out of the festival. And we went along a few years, and I said, you know, I'd like to bring a festival together in the fall with national known callers and our local guys that are, and select the local ones. I mean, you could sure have some hard feelings, but I wanted to give our boys something to do, get them moved up, and let them a chance to rub elbows. And so, for 5 years. We ran the Washington Cotillion. It was about 2,500 people, a 3-day cotillion, and it was great. Who was on my staff? Jack Lasry, Ken Bauer, Burl Main. We had Jerry Haig. I mean, these guys are, you know, they're fantastic callers, and still are. Well, those guys came in and supported me year after year, and the local callers got to dance or got to call off stage with them, and they would work hard at it. And by the way, they just built their talents up. It was a natural thing. But then the Washington Hilton was the place where we were located in. They got a little greedy, and, you know, they wanted more rooms, more money, and local people weren't taking the rooms, so I had to give up on it. But at least it was while it was running, it was a successful thing. And I was proud to do that.
Right.
We got it organized, and probably the one thing that I'm most proud of is just in the last 5 years has happened. It's not anything I did, it's just I had somewhat of a reputation in Virginia as an old timer, and they came to me, a bunch of people out of Norfolk, Virginia, and said, "Would you?" Well, Bob Worley was one of the callers who came to me, and he said, "Would you start a square dance callers association in the state of Virginia? We're starting a Virginia square dance and round dance association by the dance people, and they want to have the national here in Virginia someday, so you got to have a caller association. Would you start it?" Well, I hum on around a bit. Oh, boy. Here I am taking on it. Here I was, I guess I was 60 about that point. And what am I doing getting back into this? Well, finally, Worley, I stayed on one foot and the other. He says, "Look, quit stomping around. Do you want it or aren't you going to do it?" So I did take it on, and we organized the Virginia State Color Association, which, by all the mistakes I'd seen all around the country, I knew kind of which way to go with this thing. And we started, and we had growing pains for a while, and the dance organization and the colored organization were like this, and Mammon and I got them together, kind of slammed things together and stood my ground here and there, and pretty soon we developed a very true dancer-caller relationship in the state of Virginia. It's just marvelous. They're 100% behind us, that organization, and they run a state convention every year, and any caller wants to sign up, he gets on the stage.
Yeah.
Somewhere we put him on the stage. Well, that's just been one of the greatest things I can see, because it's been so healthy.
Sure.
So when everything else is kind of going down and the big festival-style things are going out of focus, then this sort of grassroots thing has begun to build up. And as a result, in most of the state of Virginia, things are building very nicely. They're building up. They're not great, but they're healthy.
Yeah.
Except where I am in Washington, D.C., and it's pretty much a desert there now. That's one of the bigger things I've been involved and enjoyed being a part of.
Right.
I think I'm still in it because of Dick Letcher.
Yeah.
No, if I know him. When I've been calling about 30 years, and I get off into my soapbox here a little bit, but I never was happy with the style of calling that I had learned to do when I was gone. It seemed to me it always was something missing. I could get the crowds, we could do it, but there was something missing in the whole thing. And I couldn't figure out what to do. Well, early in my career in 1949, when I was in Texas, ran into Ricky Holden. You know Ricky Holden?
Sure.
In fact, I still know. I'm still in touch with him.
Oh.
Ricky was, of course, the legend at that time.
Yeah.
There wasn't anything could touch him.
Right.
So I went to Ricky, and I said, I was learning to call, and I told him, I said, look, what's the secret to calling? And Ricky looked at me, and I'll never forget what he said. It took me 30 years to figure it out. He said, the idea is to get the music and the dancer together and get out of the road. And I figured, and I worried about that, and I stewed about it, and the more I got tired of listening to myself, the more I got to thinking about this. So, when I was taking color coach examination, why, John Jones and Frank Lane were my monitors.
Okay.
And they suggested I go take another color college, go to somebody else's color college before I get my credentials so I'd see how they worked. Because I had never run a so-called color college like Bill Peters and them had set up.
Right.
So I went up to see Dick Legend. I said, Dick, I'd called with him many years before down at the festival. I said, we'd kept in touch. And Dick, I'd like to come up and hear what you're doing with these colors, because you got something different. At the color lab, he was always on the outside trying to get and say, look, this is the way to go. So I said, now, I don't want anybody to know who I am. I just want to come up there. I want to take your little beginner's thing and see how you work with the beginner callers and what you're doing, because I'm becoming color coach. And besides, I said, I think I'm just about ready to quit. So I got up there, and first day, second day, I couldn't figure out what he was doing. I just couldn't say, what in the heck? Why is he, what's this? And I tried to do what he wanted, and I wasn't very good at it, but I was catching a hold. Well, I finally, one afternoon, I failed it so bad. I said, I'm going home. I'm going to pack my bags, get out of here. I'll never be a caller. I'm through. I don't want to call anymore. I got there and about got my bag packed. I don't think Dick knows this. I just about got that bag packed. And all of a sudden, the light bulb turned on. I says, here's how you get the dancer and the music together, and you stay out of the road.
Okay.
And Dick was working it that way. See?
Right.
Well, that just opened up a whole new world to me. And I went into prompt calling style of thing and developed the ability to listen to the music and let that music take a hold of them and get back and out of the road. And then I got in, of course, Angus McMoran, and got me into Contra in Ottawa. Then I got into Contra, and then I just went into all the disciplines, and it's been a godsend to me. I would have quit 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's all there, and I just love it. I just love it.
Yeah. Well, that's really great.
That's fantastic how it's happened. It's an accident, I guess, but everything happens as an accident.
Yeah, I guess you're
that's,
right.
That was kind of the way it got with me.
Have you been doing anything with round dancing?
Yes, I do. I'm cueing. I've got two rounds. I don't try to teach. I leave that up to the people who are truly round dance leader teachers. But I will cue. I cue phase two.
Yeah.
Maybe into a little over into phase three a little bit. But I cue all my square dances. And thanks to Dick and thing, you learn to read the music better and feel it. So every time I've done, now that I'm doing Contras, I've got my Contra clubs going and my round dancing I do, it has just spilled over into my square dance calling. So that it just seems to flow now, and I'm so relaxed with it.
Yeah.
I found out something else too, that when you can handle this prompt style, they call it. I know what I'm doing. It's not necessarily at all prompting, but when you fall into this, you don't have to have so much complicated mechanical choreographic puzzle solving type of dances.
Right.
You can back off and do the nicer, smoother, the simpler things, and the people don't know. They're happy with that music. They can feel that number one beat hit them in the foot,
yeah,
and away they go. And that's made all the difference in the world for me, but it really has. Just to say how it is. I'm so involved in training callers. I have the Virginia State Callers Seminar. I have a symposium every year that through the Color Association, I hold a seminar directed. And we bring in people to do various phases, various things about calling and round dance leading and line dancing now. Right. I'm into lines, and so we have a Western line dance teacher in. But I keep trying to tell the callers, it's just one simple thing you have to do. I don't care whether you what you call it. You got to start your command. Well, whenever you start your command, I don't care whether you do it 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3. But I want you to have your, I want your voice stop. I want you to shut up totally when beat 1, 3, 5, or 7 hit. When any of there's four places you can put your call, and everything's built in 2s, 4s, 6s, 8s.
Right.
And they'll sit there and they'll nod at me and say, but I want you to shut up before that next heavy beat because that belongs to dancer.
Okay.
Those anchor beats, you know?
Right.
1, 3, 5, 7. There's the four places that, the dancer wants to be able to put a foot down on and hear it for himself.
Okay.
Just like we do out here, you know,
right.
Like here at York. It's just you feel the music.
Yes.
And the guys will nod their head. But I don't think I'm doing a very good job. I don't get much of it across. Once in a while, I'll find a Christian. You'll get a guy who'll take a hold of it and says, yeah, that's it.
That's
now I know how to do it.
Right.
That's my big pressure now, is to try to get callers to learn to meter.
Yeah.
Meter those commands inside of those anchor beats. If they'll do that, I think square dancing would take a new birth.
Okay.
Because it sounds, then it feels like contra, it feels like a round, it feels like dancing, instead of climbing and stomping around.
Yeah. Well, let's get off square dancing for a minute.
Okay.
Tell us a little.
I'm sorry I got on soapbox there, but...
No, that's just fine.
That's my philosophy.
Good. I'll ask you more about that as we go along. But you were involved in flying for a while.
I wanted to fly badly when I was sent to the Air Force from field artillery in Fort Sill. And they sent me to Randolph Field, and boy, I wanted to fly so bad.
Yeah.
And I took the physicals and everything, and ended up, I was so colorblind, they wouldn't let me in. So I still wanted to fly, so I just went out. I could pass the Sahara test. I could pass the color test, but not enough for the Air Force. So I started flying, and I flew all light stuff, light planes.
Yeah.
Finally got to fly in twins, did some time in a 404, Cessna, 310s, 210s, those kind of the Piper Apaches and things. I flew just for fun. I would once in a while fly up to square dances, you know.
I'm no longer flying. I had to quit last year.
Yeah, well.
Diabetes caught up with me a little bit. My pancreas decided to retire a little bit.
Oh, is that right?
So FAA said, no, I think you better not anymore.
Okay. But, we had a little interruption there with a key turning in the lock, and Big Brother Al just came in.
Yes, yes. Great to see you.
So, we had a little interruption, so let's see if we can finish off. Have you done any recording?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not much for it. I did, in 1950s, I did a couple of recordings on RCA. Then in the 60s, I recorded a little bit with Grand and Top, one or two records.
Yeah.
I never really enjoyed recording. I just didn't feel good about it. I didn't feel I was that good, you know?
Okay.
And I didn't want to sound bad. Then I recorded a contra about 8, 9, 10 years ago. And then I said, I'm not a recording artist.
Okay.
I'm just kind of an old hack caller, and I get up there and bang away.
Yeah.
Like Lute used to say, do like Les Scott, just spread your legs and yell.
Yeah. Okay. I hadn't heard that one. Let me ask you something serious. What do you find is the appeal to calling square dances?
Appeal to call?
Yeah.
There are several of them. Several appeals. I probably shouldn't say this. I'm going to say it anyhow. I think that the majority of guys, at least, who come out into the calling field
are they're not quite what they think they'd like to be. They've got a job. Maybe it's not a high-paying job. Maybe, you know, normally it's not. And they're maybe thinking about adding a little bit of supplement to their income if they can develop some talent. But they more want to be up in front of people and be recognized. There's something lacking in their life that they'd like to have a little more recognition, some more than others.
Yeah.
But I think the money aspect is not, in most cases, the major problem, although it siphons into it. It ciphers into the system.
Right.
I sense more a need to just be up in front of people and be recognized a bit. They'll never say it,
yeah.
But I sense that's what it is. And then sometimes, though, you get someone who just purely likes the rhythms and is just a natural.
Right.
I don't think you can ever teach a man to call. You can teach him the mechanics. You can put it out there in front of him. It's like you say, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And if the guy hasn't got it, he'll never get it.
Yeah.
All you can do, and we in the colorist training thing, I feel, is just give the guy the mechanicals, try and let him try, and if you can call, you'll do it on your own. You'll learn on your own.
Right.
By listening to others and emulating other callers. Problem today is most callers start, turn a record over, and listen to the guy on one side, and he turns back over, copies him, and makes all his mistakes.
Yeah.
Everything he's doing wrong, he copies, thinking that's the way to go.
Right.
And that's been one of our bad factors.
Yeah.
Young callers trying to train them. But, you know, the guy who comes up, starts nosing around your record case, see what you're doing, that's the way it is. That's a guy who might be a potential caller,
yeah.
Or a gal in these cases.
Yeah.
And once in a while, you find one with some natural talent. And when you do, all you can say, here's the way, and you give them a little few hints of some ways to do the mechanicals, and he takes off.
Right.
I've never been able to hold on to but one or two callers long enough to teach them the art of calling. They just get out there and start hammering.
Yeah, right.
But the guy with good talent and thoughts, they can, that's about how they learn.
Well, as a caller coach, what's your take on, do you think callers are...
...to themselves? I think most of the callers do want to sound good. That's the reason they started the first beat. So they sound like the music when they
right.
shouldn't be. They should be back in the background.
Yeah.
Where the dancer doesn't look at them up front. They need to be behind the music instead of up front of it.
Right.
And a lot of them, I don't know whether they tape themselves. I guess young callers do. Once in a while I'll have a young caller tape himself and then I'll have a session with him, but that always, it hasn't had a lot of effect on them. They still go back to their habits.
Yeah.
Once a caller's called 3 years, I think his habits are so established, unless he has a feel of music
yeah.
and is tired of listening to himself, then he's done. He's,
yeah.
That's all he'll ever be.
Do you do any caller coaching by mail, critiquing tape recordings and so forth?
I haven't done but one.
Is that right?
Yeah, and it was, and that was some guy in England.
Yeah,
young caller in England.
I didn't understand
like
that.
But I've written a little manual on the art of calling that I've kept, and when I have a student or apprentice or something. I give them that and explain it and then have them go through the exercises with it.
Yeah.
If a guy can find the music, fine. If he can't, then, you know, it's hard. As one guy said, how come you're saying that we should do all this and 99% of the people I hear are doing the other way?
Yeah.
I said, I understand what you're saying.
Right.
You're going to follow them. You're going to follow them.
Yeah.
Here they go, making everybody's bad mistakes.
Yeah.
But it'll straighten up. People will begin to learn. And I think that Ledger's system of calling, his ideas, his concepts are beginning to catch hold. I know I'm feeding them through. I got a letter from, I did a seminar down in Texas to the Texas Caller Association. A couple of years I went down there and I did this art of calling thing and trying to get them to listen to feeling of timing. I got a letter from one of the callers here the other day and he says,
what you tried to give them, that I begin to see taking a hold around the edges. Some of them are listening. Some of them thought somehow I had an effect on them. That makes me feel good.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, at least he says they're listening to their timing. They're, you know, trying to run all over everybody.
Well, now we're talking, actually we're talking CVP program, too.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
In my sense, I think that is the total answer.
Yeah.
Until square dancing becomes, as such, per se, tunnel square dancing, becomes so down, and they see things like Cal's doing, and I'm doing, and others of us, Dick and things, that they'll say, hey, these guys are still running.
Yeah.
How am I still calling 46 years of calling? If I hadn't done something to change to go with the system. And I'm convinced that a caller has got to develop a lot more talent. He's got to learn to prompt. He's got to learn these contours. He has to learn some rounds, possibly rounds, line dancing, circles. My God, the circle dances are wonderful. But in the early days, the round dance people did the circle dances, and they made them so complicated, people would walk away from them.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you've got simple circles that are just wonderful. And there's so many different kinds, and they should be a part of every college program.
Right.
Because if you don't, hey, you're just a tunnel. There you go, right on up into the sky, and
yeah,
all the dancers are gone.
You get up there, and there's nobody left to dance with.
There's nobody up there anyhow. Then they drop off the end of the cliff.
Yeah.
But
I think it was John Jones told me about it. He was calling a festival with one of the old timers, like Red Warwick or something.
Yeah.
And another guy was throwing the floor constantly in front of him. Red said, John, he said, you know, look at that guy. He's such a good caller. Nobody can dance to him.
That's true. Warwick had a sense of humor, didn't he?
Oh, I tell you.
Yeah. I met Red one time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was calling down in Ohio somewhere there, and Red showed up to dance.
Yeah. No, but you're pretty well gotten into one of the questions I've asked everybody. Where do you think square dancing has been, and where do you think it is, and where do you think it's going? And we've talked about this a little bit, but what's your overview?
For the future?
Yeah.
Well, square dancing started as, in my feelings, it started with a lot of the cultural elements strong in it. It was a cultural, it's a people's thing.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot of that from Evan Jenkins. It's a lot to do with the togetherness of getting people together and giving them just a simple evening of fun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe the simple evenings of fun we had 50 years ago has changed a lot. People are more sophisticated now. They want a little something more than just two head ladies cross over by your opposite stand, as I gave it.
Right.
But it's I hope returning to its cultural roots. I don't know how it's going to happen, but I think square dancing will get worse. It's going to go down more before it comes back. And when it comes back, it'll come back in a new direction,
right,
with CDP, so-called CD,
yeah,
being the element there involved. I liked the idea of the caller, the community dance program that Cal and them, and I think it was Jim Mayo, started in the Colorland thing.
Right.
And Cal, of course, pushed it on and on.
Yeah.
I liked the idea, but I felt they kind of straitjacketed. The idea, the concept was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Let's diversify. There wasn't a farmer ever, or a rancher, Ed never made it if he didn't diversify his crops.
Right.
We're in the same position.
Mm-hmm.
The caller who just stays with square dancing is going to continue to lose. It's just going to drop down to minimum.
Right.
I see it now, basement group starting again in Washington. That's where it was when I started in 48, 49, 50.
Yeah.
Just basement groups. Once in a while you have a little dance. And then it exploded, and I saw Evan Jenkins go with that in Washington, and it exploded under my eyes into 100 squares in about 3 years,
right,
from just little dance groups.
Right.
And then we took it and started to run with it, and we callers got a hold of it, and the dance hobbyists, the loud ones, kept saying more and more and more, right. And the callers went better more and more. And if it hadn't been for Color Lab coming in at the time it did, I don't know. Osgood hadn't started Color Lab going.
Yeah.
With Lee Hellis on that group, you know the guys.
Sure.
The old timers I've all mentioned.
Right.
If it hadn't started, I don't know where it would have gone, because it was just going completely crazy, just erupting everywhere in volcanic stuff, just junk coming in. And we haven't completely cleaned that out yet.
Yeah.
It's coming, but it may come with the older folks wanting to dance. You know, at this point, maybe we never will again have it get back to its cultural roots until the age of the population becomes a great part of the population rather than the young ones. As they get older, people begin to look back to the cultural roots of it, or socialize. I guess they call it more socializing. I think socializing has to be a very heavy part of the dance action. And I say this, where you can dance and laugh with each other and joke and tell a little thing and have fun going on in your group while you're dancing.
Right.
When it gets too complex, you got to concentrate too much on it, the fun element goes out of it.
Yeah.
And therefore the social element goes out of it. You dance with some, like in the lines down here, some poor person, if it's a complicated dance and he's new and he's lost, I think you've lost him.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's gone. Mm-hmm. These people have got to keep it, and they do. We do, in the contract, keep it simple enough. And I'm bad in the squares. I've got back to the point where I even feel a mainstream program is a little heavy nowadays, you know?
Right.
It is. The program I'm working is purely with seniors, but it's exploding again. Because in my area, there's a lot of seniors who have retired or looking for outlet, looking for social activity.
Right.
And I hope the younger crowd, and they've got to. There isn't any way the younger ones can get older and not want to be together.
Yeah.
I'm hoping the computer age will get so... Well, I think the computer age is already here, where everybody's so involved with their computer, they don't have any social outlet. There's no social intercourse between people. They're on that machine all day. They go home, if they got a home, and sit it. Get on the tube and this.
Yeah.
I hope as people get older, they will realize, hey, this isn't the world. You know, we are the people. And I hope it gets back to some of its cultural roots. I think some of the traditional dance like they do here, I know one fellow in my group, a senior group, is a historian. He says, would you do one traditional dance every time? It's just a basic program. I've got 48 basics, that's it, with all the other dancing, this discipline we do. And he said, would you do it? I said, all right, I'll try. So I went back and dug in, got some more traditional, some of the nicer things.
Mm-hmm.
Not some of the trash they had. They got some of the nicer things. And the people absolutely loved it. Visiting couple.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, that's great. Let's do that every time. Just have one. It's fine. Now, it isn't going to be the whole movement, but it's getting back to roots a bit, I think.
Right.
In the music. Because, you know, you can get it going, you can shut up, and they'll dance the thing. And everybody says, hey, look at us. We did it.
Yeah. Right.
Feeling of togetherness. If we don't foster that, there's no way to go.
Yeah.
And I think it has to go back to it. That's my feeling. Well,
of course, our record companies are not contributing very much to this cause.
No, they're not.
Everything is a two-beat.
Everything's plain old beat.
And you can't even find a phrase in a lot of them.
But I heard the other day some of the record publishers are saying, our crowd is older. We've got to get back to their music.
Yeah.
And I noticed there are some of the companies, recording companies, are now coming back with some old songs that people can relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And that maybe will have something to do with helping them bring it back in that sense.
Yeah.
But the record companies have gone to, you know, this, what is this? Oh, what's
I can't even think of Neutron or something that they did.
Oh, yeah, and the young caller just thought it was the greatest. Yeah. I danced to it, and I said, good night. I can't even find a place to put my foot down.
Yeah.
Well, it, with the record companies, I understand they are looking very strongly at appealing to the older crowd now, because that is the gray heads are the dancers.
Right.
And I think we as the square dance groupings or associations as a whole, we the callers have got to start looking to those people,
right,
and working toward them.
Well, don't you do you feel, I should say, that we no way that we're going to be able to convert our present day dancers back to the CDP program?
No. No, they're lost.
In other words, we've got to start
over. We've got to start over. You know, when you start a class, you need to put a little of circles in it, a little something different along with the square. Then they begin to say, yeah, this is the way it goes.
Yeah.
And I do. And I'm seeing a great deal of acceptance of this.
Right.
Because even if you do nothing but, as good as Contra is, if you do nothing but Contra, it can get stultifying.
Right.
I don't care how much you change the patterns, the music,
yeah,
it's stultifying. So you need that change.
Yeah.
Change of formations.
Change
of
formations.
And change of music, even.
And change of rhythm.
Change of rhythm.
Right.
In my line dance program, and I'm doing line dance teaching now, and then I started out working with country western, and I did a little of it, but then I found that little two-step line dances and waltz dances. I made Saturday night. I may go out and do a waltz, a solo dance. And so I'm teaching Teresa's Waltz, one of the most beautiful little moves that people just love to get on the floor and do it. You got to have change of rhythms.
Mm-hmm.
And well, of course, Don Armstrong has been long. I've quoted his article many times that he wrote, you know, along several years ago.
Right.
He says, if you don't diversify your rhythms, there's nothing going on.
Right.
You've got to change. And I'm 100% with it. I guess I'm still here because I have gone that route.
Right.
But again, I go back to Dick Ledger and say, if I hadn't gone up there to him that day, that light bulb hadn't turned on,
right,
I wouldn't be here today. I'd
well,
be gone.
Give us that philosophy of Ricky's again.
Ricky's?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That stuck with me now for 45 years. Yeah, he says, if you learn to put the dancer and the music together and get out of the road, you can become a caller.
There you go.
And he says, if you can do it only 50% of the time, you're going to be an excellent caller.
Right.
Yeah. And that is true. And in another way, I heard Ledger say the same thing. He says, if you can get those people back on that first beat of a phrase about every 16, you can let go of 8, or you can maybe let go of a 16, but you got to be there every other time at least.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced of that. That was Ricky's approach. And I thought it was great.
That's great.
It's about the simplest thing you could ever tell a guy.
And
it took me 30 years to figure out what he meant. You know?
Okay.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah.
I saw him here a couple, 3 years ago. He came back through Washington.
Did he really?
Raised the phone. Yeah. And hey, this is Ricky. I hadn't seen him in 30 years, you know?
Yeah.
And he had his new daughter with him, little daughter. She was taking her through the States. But he's living in Belgium, and I heard from him last time. I heard from him, he was in Bulgaria doing Bulgarian dances. That guy is just traveling all over the world.
Yeah.
Still
you know those progressive grand circles I did on the folk craft?
Yeah.
He was the one that created the music in Belgium.
He did?
Yeah.
I'll be there. Well, yeah. We do sort of link that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never let go of him. He always was the one that I looked back at and said, you had the answers.
Right.
And he did. He really did. Well, of course, I had one of the greatest compliments of my life when I was calling about 2 years. I'd been calling about 2 years, and Ed Jenkins had a big festival, and I got on the festival with him. They could dance, and he brought all the local callers in, and we were calling. And Pappy and what's her name, Miss Shaw?
Dorothy.
Happy and Dorothy were sitting there, and this was the thing. Here they were sitting in all, we were all just like, here's Pappy Shaw.
Right.
And I got up and called some dance, I will, where it was. And I remember I got on, then I got to see Pappy and Dorothy. And she said, you know, you sound like Ricky Holden.
There you go.
I had copied him. I didn't realize
it,
but I had copied him to a large extent. So that was a great compliment, I thought.
Oh, I guess so.
My mentor, so to speak. But I had a lot of people have had a lot of effect on me. I give credit to a lot of guys that I've rubbed elbows with. Les Scotcher's style of razzle dazzle calling, I picked up on that.
Yeah.
Amalgamated with Eastern and things, and there's so many things. You know, as you go along, Bob, you don't realize. You look back and say, "Hey, I got that from them." I got my philosophy from Ebb Jenkins, you know. I got my education from Bob Osgood's magazine, you know. I got this from, who was it? Gilmore.
Oh, yeah.
I got the feel of music out of Gilmore, and then from the East. And so when you start looking back, you're only an amalgamation of what everybody taught you. Maybe they didn't know they were teaching.
Yeah.
But in rubbing elbows and touching base and this, that, and the other, You either last or you go out there. And the ones that have gone out are the ones that were tunnel vision.
Yeah.
Here's the way, and that's the way I'm doing it, and that's it. And you can't do it. You've got to go with the times.
Right.
You really have. And I don't know where we're going. I think it will, I think square dancing will go back down, even more down, to where we're back to the roots again. Where people will become to come together to enjoy each other rather than come together to learn more.
Yeah.
And when they get to that, and we get to that as leaders, and begin to move our new dancing people into that fold and not push them so hard, there's always a few that's going to want to race over.
Yeah.
Let them go. The cars have got to stay down where the masses are happy.
Yeah.
And, you know the old way, the old philosophy of, people, when you're done a dance and people grab their boots and run, it wasn't a good dance.
Yeah.
If they have to stick around, you got to drive them out of the hall. It was a great dance.
Yeah. Right.
There's another, this little, Flo Catmull.
Yeah.
Just bring her. I'll bring Flo into it. I've known Flo ever since Detroit, 35 years ago. And Flo is an excellent, excellent caller.
Yes.
She is. She's, I think, a perfect Fraser. She just got it. Beautiful contra. She can just, when she's prompting, I want to get on the floor. Flo says, I don't know, Flo. So I don't know much about calling. But she says, I can tell whether a caller is doing a good job or not because I sit on the side of the floor and I watch people's feet. And if people's feet are hitting down all over the place and nobody's together, he isn't doing a good job. But when they got their feet together and everybody's in rhythm with the music, you can see the feet coming down together. He says, that's doing a good job. She had a good philosophy.
Yeah, good thought.
Said, I don't know what he's doing wrong, but he can't be doing much right because his feet are going everywhere. People are slamming around over the floor. And 90% of it is now because the caller takes beat one. And he says, okay, two ladies chain. And where's the dancer going to start? Beat two, two and a half, three, four? No, he's either got to wait till five or he's got to start. So he starts.
Yeah.
And everybody starts on a different beat. And I can't get that across.
Yeah.
I don't know why. If you just shut up and let that heavy beat hit him in the foot, the guy will go.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was doing a one-night stand one time.
Get out of the road.
That's right. Get out of the road. I did a one-night stand one night. It was an old Italian guy. And I was in a big old mill, and we were stomping. Everybody was clobbered up, reception, wedding reception. I had an orchestra, and we were going away at it. It was one of those circle left dances. That's about all you can do.
Yeah.
And everybody was flobbing around. But this old man got up, and he says, you got him in the feet, buddy. You got him in the feet. So that's the answer. You got their feet going together. Yeah, as if. Wonderful memories. Good Lord. Yeah, Squinette's been very good to Lou and I. Lou's always worked the other side of it. We've always been a team. Lou's, well, I wouldn't carry it on Lou with me.
Sure.
With it, because she loves the people. She loves the social aspect. She tries to make everybody come in the hall feel like it's her home. Mm-hmm. And greet them and get them and take them and talk with them and listen to their stories about their children. And she really is intensely interested in people. So we've had a good relationship that way.
That's great.
Oh, God. I could have never been. Without her, I wouldn't have been
sure.
I would have never done it. Yeah. She's been very much a part of my whole career. I wish she were here this weekend with Bob and you and Al and all coming. I'm going to call her tonight. Yeah, you missed it.
Okay. Well, look, Dick, I really appreciate you taking the time to put these thoughts down on tape.
First time I've ever had a chance to do it. I hope I haven't bragged too much.
No,
I don't like to brag. It hurts me. I didn't know.
The square dance corner, the brags.
I have one of those egos that doesn't like that. I like to put them together and get out of the road.
Yeah, right.
And then never even know I'm up there, just dancing. That's the idea.
That's
the way you do.
Yeah.
Even here, you know, this
sure.
country. You forget that Don's up there. You're dancing.
Yeah.
The music's talking to you. Or something comes in your ear and says, oh, I do this. That's the way it ought to be.
Yeah.
Even a square dancing. Yeah, we're just gotten too complicated. The mechanics took over the art.
Right.
And
choreography
became the god. And everybody, that's the first thing I want to do is get all this choreography. And they don't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Once if you never get it to put it to music, fine. But you don't need all the choreographics. So-called formation managements, which is a nice term, but you don't need it if you so much heavy stuff. If you've got that music pumping at them, and you know, you're right, the younger callers today, some of the music they select to call to, just I don't understand where it comes from.
Yeah.
And of course, the record companies are going because they're buying records.
Sure. Right.
But I think they're going to go back, and they will. They will. Just take time. Maybe we're all getting older and looking back and saying, it ain't like the old times.
Yeah, right.
Well, in many ways, it's better than the old times. It really is.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have to reset our sights, I think, and get back to where people are and get back to even smaller groups. Anytime you get more than 8 squares in a group, it becomes a crowd, you know?
Mm-hmm.
6 to 8 square club is about the ultimate in what I'm talking about,
right. The
social environment, because everybody gets a chance to about dance with everybody in the group every night, and yet it's big enough, if you don't like somebody, you don't have to dance with them at once. Yeah, and I think that is the ultimate. The big stuff is, I think, going. I think it will go. Maybe the national will still be a national,
sure.
Once in a year to get together, but these festivals where they're hiring all the hypers and the big young guys that get up there and screaming and everybody goes high and high and screams and yells and has a big time, I kind of think that's kind of fade out.
I hope so.
Well, it's like any other culture, you know, the good stuff stays, the bad stuff gradually fades away.
Yeah.
And we can't dictate it, Bob. We can't do anything but hang on to it. Like a bull with a tail and a downhill pull. You got to go with it. Yeah, you got to.
Right.
Okay. Well.
Okay, Dick. Thanks very much.
You bet.
I'm
glad to get a chance to talk with you.
Right.
I hope hope this gets through to somebody somewhere down the line 100 years from now.
Well, I hope so.
Okay.
Thanks, Dick.
You bet.
Bye.